netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from fxguide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this special FX Podcast. It's Mike Seymour. We're coming to you with our NAB special. In fact, we're just in the state of Nevada. We're actually leaving Las Vegas. And in fact, we just crossed the county line. And we... going to do our summary rundown of what we thought of the show, this time driving back from Vegas to LA. Hopefully this will come out right on the end of the NAB show. I thought we'd do a wrap up and covering all the things, and to do that I'm joined by my co-founder of FX Guide, Jeff Huser.
Hello, Mike.
And stepping in to this hot seat to to fill in for John Montgomery, who is on a plane and thus can't join us, is Jason Wingrove. How are you, sir?
I'm well.
Bit of a crossover, crossing the streams here between the Red Center RC podcast and, of course, the FX podcast. So what I thought we'd do is we'd work through all of the news of the show and give you our interpretation of it. Now we've had some time to sort of check out and get beyond the press releases and just discuss some of the issues at hand. So I'm going to start by actually discussing one of the bigger news items, which is Apple's decision to launch the discussion and details, I guess, to a certain extent, of the new version of Final Cut Pro. Now, Jason, you've been trying to follow this. They did this. Can you explain to people who don't know how this was launched?
Well, yeah, obviously it was not done properly at the show and not done as a proper Apple, you know, invited attend Apple keynote, I guess, as you'd be used to, with a proper follow-up QuickTime stream that you could get off their website. Essentially was done what seemed to happen quite last minute at the Final Cut user group big huge super meet that they do, which is off-site from the NAB conference itself. So unless you had sort of what was pretty much one of the hot tickets for off campus events, I guess you'd call it, then you did not attend and you had to kind of
You were saying that it was
string
like
it together
minute,
through little grabs. Everything I've seen has been like someone's iPhone video posted on YouTube, and so, you know, just 10 poor audio videos.
But they actually had people booked to speak that they then said, sorry, you can't speak because
Apple's
taking all the slots.
Apple is going to take the whole thing. We are now going to do our launch in front of you, and no other people, you know, big speakers were going to be up there. Philip Bloom and a fair few other people were all just basically said thanks but no thanks, and that Apple does want the entire stage the entire night.
Now, Jeff, there was a now confirmed session where they took a bunch of editors to some kind of remote location and showed them this a while ago, right?
Yeah, I want to say February. I know some people that were invited but couldn't go. But it was, yeah, like in February they invited some people up. But I've actually read some reports. I actually have not had a lot of time with the show going on to chase a lot of this, but I did read some reports about some people that went up there that said that what they showed here was pretty much the same thing they were shown. Same version, same kind of information. But apparently there's, you know, they've obviously been still working on it because it's supposed to be released in June. Is that correct? June? Did I get that right?
Yeah. Well, I think obviously it's tied in with the next OS of Lion, I guess. So, yeah, mid-year.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think is the question on everyone's lips was, is Final Cut going to be, you know, a dumbed-down version and like an iMovie Final Cut, or is it going to be a professional tool? Actually, I think the story that ended up being the story was that Avid decided to slash its price and then Apple super slashed its price. Do you know what the pricing is, Jess?
Yeah, $299 for, and there didn't seem to be like an express version or whatever. It just seemed to be just the one version.
No, I think the express version is 99 cents, right? Sorry.
But it's $299. It's only going to be available through the App Store, the new App Store.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah. I heard some resellers not happy about that.
And what was Avid's? Because Avid price dropped as well.
Well, I don't know if they dropped the price, did they? But I know they did this $990 if you own
$995 cross grade. I think if you're a current Final Cut Pro owner, then you could, I guess, get it for $995. Obviously, clearly the regular retail price is a lot more, $1,500 or so.
I mean, which was a hell of a deal before the show started. That was, everybody was talking about that.
Yeah, wow, that's a great deal. And
yeah,
then,
I think it's still a good deal, but
actually, we'll come back to the Final Cut in a second. But that was a trend we saw across the industry because the color grading space also had a basically a huge price war with Assimilate first slashing its prices down to you know, like half and less for the main version of Scratch and beyond, and then And we just didn't think Da Vinci could go any lower. And then Da Vinci said, you know what, we'll just do a version for free.
You know, quite a bit lower.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Da Vinci Free.
Because I was opposite IBC.
Resolve Lite, I think it's called.
Oh, really?
And it is completely, entirely free. And it is staggeringly well-featured for something that costs zero.
Wow.
I think it maybe has like two nodes.
Yeah, it's node limited.
Yep, it's still nodal, and it's essentially the same sort of layout. It's not like, you know, it's a very, very dumbed down version. You still have tracking. I think there's no, what that doesn't have is like live playback. You basically have to, you can scrub through stuff, but then you have to render out to get your final thing. But essentially you're just limited to the number of nodes, but you can still do that amazing tracking that it does, and scrub out.
So what features have we seen of the Final Cut, the new version, and it's Final Cut 10, right? That's like
X.
I heard that somebody said it wasn't X. I thought it was Final Cut 10, and the 10 was the Roman numeral X in the packaging only.
But it's supposed to be like, okay, so what we know so far is, as far as we can tell, I mean, and I have to say that one of the reasons, well, we didn't cover the actual event live because, well, it was our party that night, and it was all kind of last minute that this was announced, and frankly, we kind of realized that everybody in the world was going to be covering this event.
Well, of course, the other thing is we kind of got a heads up that we knew that it wasn't going to be, available for sale at NAB, so there's a lot to be said for actually, you know, seeing the real version and seeing what's in it. Then,
yeah, because right now we're seeing just a ton of speculation about, you know, what's going to happen when you... There's a lot of background processing, supposedly, where it automatically tracks for stability, for stabilizing clips, for identifying two shots, single shots, groups, things like that, which is all lovely stuff, but there's a lot of speculation about, will that slow the system down? And you have to think that Apple's smart enough to figure that out.
Well, of course, the fundamental thing is this is a 64-bit rewrite, because otherwise they just wouldn't be able to run it. So moving forward. So it's a major rewrite. So that should give us a lot of performance improvements.
Yeah, background rendering, I think. And the rendering times they were showing there on stage were, like, phenomenal. Like, it was literally, like, they basically changed the color of a couple of clips, and it was like a second or two and happened in the background. It wasn't stopping the editing process.
And interestingly, very, very mixed timeline type optimizations.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the thing that a lot of people are going to be really happy about. I know Premiere's been doing that now for a little while, right, since the last version. But being able to just drop stuff on a timeline as opposed to having to kind of set your timeline, pre-render all your clips to ProRes, that is all going to happen.
And it had a sort of quite nice sort of way of stacking. You know what happens if you get a few layers of video, and very, very, very quickly your timeline gets quite busy, and you sort of lose track of things. You could almost like collapse like video track 1, 2, 3 down onto one clean sort of simple timeline, and sort of pop it back out again.
Yeah, I've got to say that one of the things that we were kind of interested in was whether they were going to collapse all the different products into one. But Jason, you have seen some color correction innovations.
Ah, what looked sensational, and it didn't. What it didn't do was take you out of the whole Final Cut or the sort of like the timeline environment. Again, this is like a 100-foot view, just watching, trying to gather this information from a few little web clips. But they showed, something shot pre-dawn where it was quite cool and moody, and then another one was shot like almost like sunset, and it was quite golden. And it almost like they had this kind of like match color thing where you could say, I like the look of that, apply it to this, and it would sort of look at the color space of that clip and boom, instantaneously. And then they said, look at this, here's the render wheel. And literally by the time they'd finished saying render wheel, it had been it had finished rendering that clip and you could play it. So literally almost like cut and paste colors without actually having to go into any kind of color palette.
If I can get sort of philosophical and take a more strategic view with you guys for a second, just in terms of what this means, there were two things that I thought that were interesting. One is that Phil Schiller actually did the keynote. Now, that, I thought, was in of itself a message.
I don't know if he did it. I know he was in attendance.
He was in attendance. Ubios, is it?
But he was up on stage, wasn't he?
No, I think that he and a bunch of other really high-ranking executives were right there in the front row. And right.
Oh, okay.
Right,
I'm sorry.
But I don't think they were involved in the presentation.
It's the same guy, though, who has done the iMovie and is, of course, the head of the iMovie / Final Cut Pro group. I'm going to say Randy Ubios, but that's
my question is, I guess, do you think that this has sent enough of a message? Because there was a rumor that Apple last year was going to sell Final Cut and dump Pro Apps, and that have they sent enough of a message that that just puts all that to bed?
I heard a lot of vibe to that effect, that the fact that all those guys were there and that they were very clear to make a very strong message that this was very much aimed at the Pro App, and in fact, that's why they chose that event. That Super Meet is a very highly attended, anticipated, you know, yeah. We've been before. It's a very nice event, very, very well attended.
It's, I was entirely expecting it to suck, and entirely expecting it to be bad. I'd sort of put the feelers out for sort of the rumor mill to see what had been heard, and the only two keywords I'd heard were iMovie and hybrid, and I immediately said, I'm out.
Okay, so let me ask you a second philosophical question, or sort of a strategic question, which is, it feels to me like we've moved from a two-horse race to a three-horse race, and that if I was somebody that was considering maybe not being a full-time feature film editor, but just somebody that's editing content right now,
yeah.
I'm really picking between Avid, Final Cut, and Premiere.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
Yes,
absolutely.
Because Premiere seems to have done a lot of work to have closed the gap on the things that were stopping people from being able to actually edit with it. Like, for a start, completely deserting Premiere was and undoing that mistake was a good start by Avid. But then they just continued. It's not like they came back Adobe with Premiere and then haven't touched it since. Like, they've been continuing to improve it. And we saw at the show 5.5 being released.
Yeah, major release updates, almost every couple of months. Quite impressive.
Now, John Montgomery's got a really good interview with the Adobe guys, which is in the second of our FX Guide TV episodes coming from Las Vegas. The third one. The second one, Jace, you and I were covering cameras with Red and Ari. And, of course, the first one, we're looking at things like codecs and stuff. So those three episodes, the third of which will be up at the beginning of next week, are our sort of video stuff from... But I felt Adobe was really, firing. Like, I really have felt, as I think I felt last year, that Avid had really come back solidly. I don't think Adobe had ever gone away, but it really felt like Adobe had some high-end focus, because a lot of the stuff in 5.5 didn't seem to be the sort of things that you're putting in for the masses. They really seemed to be kind of points that were more for hardcore users. Is that your impression?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think they're just doing solid stuff. They're starting to roll a lot of the good research type stuff into productization. Like that warp stabilized thing they've done this year. They're really, heading in the right direction, and they keep improving stuff.
So for all of those products, especially Premiere and Final Cut, Thunderbolt is really significant. Now, Jeff, you saw some rendering stuff, actually, I think it was After Effects related, but there was some test stuff running with Thunderbolt at the show. Thunderbolt, of course, announced before the show as the new high-speed 10-up, 10-down kind of really powerful format for connecting drives and monitors to laptops. But the significance of just having a faster drive is not fully realized yet, because the announcement pre-NAB wasn't so far ahead of NAB that you could really have people... with working machines that were using it or right. drives that were doing it, but everybody was talking about it.
Right.
That's when I got the
sense. Promise had on their booth, and also in the Adobe booth and a bunch of other places, anybody that was showing Thunderbolt was pretty much showing Promise drives. And they were, I think they were SSD drives, like a 4-bay box using Thunderbolt. And the stuff they were showing in the Adobe booth was just amazing. I mean, it was really multi-layer timelines, 4K stuff. Just scrolling through it, After Effects stuff, rendering snow over over a scene in real time. I mean, it was really fast and powerful. And if you do check out that FX Guide TV, I'd recommend it highly. John Montgomery talked to the guy from G-Tech, really in-depth technical explanation of why Thunderbolt works the way it does and how it works. The thing I didn't realize is that I thought it was just one bus. You know, it's kind of like you plug in a USB and you daisy chain. Physically, it works the same way. But in that wire... the video path is actually separate from the data path. So your video is uninterrupted. Your data path is not hurting it in any way, shape, or form. And the other big significant thing is, if you put six drives on there as separate ports, on the loop, on the drive chain of that part of the Thunderbolt, there's no performance impact between them. They don't affect each other, nor does throughput up or down. If you're uploading and downloading, that's not affecting each other.
It is a really significant technology. I mean, in one sense, you could say, well, what do I care? It's just a faster drive. But as John covered really well in that app, there's a lot of significant things that happen. I mean, for example, it's so fast you can offload graphics boards and back. And so the performance you were seeing in After Effects is just astounding. And of course, it frees up the people that are writing the software to do a bunch of new things. So there's going to be a second knock-on effect come release of, say, CS6. I mean, I can just bet that's going to have like a ton.
And it also means you can have like desktop graphical power in a laptop, right? Because it's
absolutely.
It's off like the Blackmagic box we saw had a SDI and HDMI ins and outs, and it was all obviously outboard of a laptop.
So you mentioned there the SSDs. I found SSDs to be the new tape at this show. That was a real theme that I saw.
I even saw one of them. I think it was on Blackmagic. They actually looked like they were in a Digibeta box. You know, they looked very physically like a blue plastic case.
Yeah, it's just funny that, wasn't it? And on the same Blackmagic booth, they had a really interesting system. Now, Jace, we saw a couple of systems that would attach to the back of a camera, be it an Epic or an SLR, that would be a solid-state recorder that would allow you to record the output. Now, in the case of an SLR, it's less useful because you don't get a clean 1920 by 1080 signal, but there are a lot of video cameras that do, and they would come out in either HDMI or HD SDI. And one of the ones on the Blackmagic booth that took my fancy was one that basically is like a kind of a large cigarette, maybe two cigarette boxes next to each other, but not too big, and you would put an SSD in it. That's $350.
$395, I think.
But you slid the drive in, right? It was like a slot.
Slot, and you put the drive in. Now, it has no monitoring on it, and we'll discuss some others in a second that do. That's all it did, right? And it would record the video. The thing about it that I found phenomenally interesting is that when you pop out that SSD, which is a standard off-the-shelf SSD, so you can use any manufacturer, it's not like it's proprietary to Blackmagic. Of course, you could wander back and use that manufacturer's little thing at your laptop to download those files. And so, of course, if someone comes out with one that happens to be Thunderbolt, you could use that. But the interesting thing is Blackmagic made one that read those SSDs that was rack-mounted, 1U high, that had machine control. So it would literally emulate a Digi or a VTR or an SR deck, whatever you want. So instead of having two SR decks in your rack, you would walk back and plug these two SSDs in to the one rack unit high thing and then connect those up to a flame, to a smoke, to a mixing desk, to a Grass Valley, to whatever you liked, and it would just have full tape machine control like a normal VTR. Now that is so
that
designed.
That is just clever.
Yeah, it's got LCD, LCD display on the front. You can preview the video that's on there. Obviously you've got all the transport controls on the front. It's got two slots for SSDs so you can actually keep hot swapping and it can do a rolling record. They really want to sort of brand SSDs as you saw with those snap cases. They sell like snap cases now with almost like quite branded, like SSD is some new tape format. You know, it's the next sort of record. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a conscious effort to do that, and it really makes sense.
The thing I've been waiting for, obviously a lot of this is being motivated by the tragedies in Japan with the factories of SR tapes being shut down and severely impacting the tape workflow, and we're going to be seeing a lot of this. I'm really surprised there wasn't more push for, like, okay, you've got all these SSDs, but this stuff all eventually has to end up on some sort of, you know, like LTO or something.
I think that's going to be next year. I think next year is going to be it. Actually, I should just say, I know you guys are joining us on this drive from Vegas to LA. I just wish you could see how beautiful it is here. This is a dawn drive back, and we've got lovely Joshua trees, and it is just, if you've never done the drive from Vegas to LA, while we're talking, you have to imagine us driving through this gorgeous, very flat and desolate, but just wonderful. Are we in California now, Jeff?
We're in California now.
We're now in California.
It's
California.
Your conscious choice to do this every year, isn't it, Mike?
It is. Instead of flying, I hate it. And Jace, I'm so glad you could join us. So, okay, so let's
go back to the SSD for a sec.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's continue that.
Theoretically, this. I don't have much involvement with SSDs, but the theory is that they're a little bit more not just the fact that they're faster, but there is a robustness. It's like essentially like having a rated spinning medium.
Yeah, system, a lack of moving parts.
But it has a much more greater sort of data integrity to it. Is that right? And it's going to stay, have better shelf life without sort of being, you know, have to like turn your drive on every year.
I don't know about
it's
that.
It is not designed for long-term shelf storage.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's one of the most expensive ways to shelf store anything. But I think that that's not really where I was thinking it was being used. I think it was a lot of it was just like cycled media. Like, unlike tape, where, let's face it, Jeff, how many times were we in a facility that people would refuse to even once recycle an SR tape or a Digibeta?
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, the thing about the SSDs, and we've been doing it, Chase, with the RED camera, with the Epic. You know, I mean, how many times even this trip have we shot with the same magazines over and over and over again?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's essential.
Well,
but just the question came up only because the more they start to brand it as this, you know, put it in a cassette box and, you know, more to brand it as a kind of a, that sort of storage system. I just wondered.
Well, it's still pretty pricey. Because there's two types of SSD, right? There's one type that's what we sort of knowingly called military spec, which doesn't have any dip in its record, and I think we've spoken about this, Jace, over on RC. So it records with a very, very constant data flow, so it doesn't have any interruption. So if you're using it as a source record, it's going to be really good. And then there's the sort that you would have, say I have an SSD in my laptop as my second drive, and that one, well, it can have a dip, because I really don't care if I'm writing to the drive, if it has to pause momentarily when saving out a QuickTime, as long as it's not feeding in live and therefore going to have a drop frame. And so the good stuff, the good SSD stuff, is still really pretty pricey.
Right, so but when you're purchasing that, you're well aware of which grade you're buying. They have like SSD good and SSD meh.
Well, it's SSD, yeah. I mean, there's, well, for example, on the Codex came out with this box, which is a DIT station. So you would have imagine something, it's in FX Sky TV, but imagine you've got something that's the footprint of a 17-inch laptop, and underneath that, it has basically a computer without a screen, and all that the laptop I'm doing at the top is literally controlling the bottom via Ethernet. I would come up and I'd stick my SSDs from my Epic, for example, in the side of it, and it would clone those off to other SSDs, but those second SSDs are not the normal Codex, really expensive thing that we were using when we were shooting stereo with the Alexa, because they are the mil-spec ones. So these are the less expensive versions, and they're 1 or 2 terabyte drives, and you would pop those, and those would be the transport drives that you'd take back. So reliable, reusable, but not the incredibly expensive type. So the only reason I say that is that in that case, Codex has two different types of drives. They have the on-camera recorders, which are the really high quality mega cool ones, and then the transport ones. But I would be wrong if I gave the impression that the second tier is kind of the bad quality or the less quality. It's just simply that it doesn't have the sustained data write that is vital when recording, say, dual Alexas off a stereo rig.
Well, it's funny, on that first day when we were shooting the interview with Mark Dando about the Codex box, which was really focused on set,
yep,
I hadn't really put this all together in my head, but after walking the floor and seeing the number of recording devices that are recording to compact flash, SSD, whatever, I really think that we're going to end up shooting a job, keeping it on SSDs and doing things like that clever thing Blackmagic did for the rack, working with the material, copying it over to the servers and stuff in the facility to work on it, but then again also having to do the same type of functions that a DIT would do. I mean, it has to get backed up, it has to get, you know, it's...
Well, that Codex box, you can connect an LTO to it.
Right.
And
what I liked about that box was you could say, here's my workflow, and it's, you literally put the media in and it follows those instructions that are designed for that workflow.
And you can lock the function, so the person that's the tape op can't change the base time rate, for example.
Right.
You can lock off a whole bunch of functions.
See, I could definitely see myself using that stuff, because my setup's more a bit more Soho, is a bit more kind of, you know, small home office editing setup. But I don't have, like, you know, the server rooms and the huge tape rooms and LTOs and all that kind of archiving back office. So if the SSDs aren't really designed to be, and rightly so, designed to be the sort of archiving thing, I guess there needs to be to work out what the LTO for the rest of us is.
No, but I think LTO is the LTO for the rest of us, because an LTO can run at pretty much SR type data rates now.
Yeah.
So you can run, it's like virtually like real time SR, HDSR. So you would connect an LTO drive up to that box. Now, Jace, that box, I actually think it's like $15,000, maybe a little less.
Yeah.
That box could be something you could actually want, because you could have it on set and you could use it just to clear your SSDs, but without a lot of, no cabling, no carry-on, no fuss.
Yeah.
You stick your laptop on it, and then when you went home, you'd be able to have it at home as the playout station, but also your archiving system, as well as your, and you would use it in that kind of indie, small, it'd be both, basically.
Well, it's $15,000 and something that I want. Doesn't quite gel, but anyway.
Don't think that $15,000 is something you can afford? For that kind of... Not you personally.
Well, the current version of that for me would be like this sort of... I suppose like, a whole $300 or $400 storage array with, just cheap, green drives or something in it.
Well, don't get me wrong. You could do that.
But when we're shooting on set, you're just going to chew SSDs.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why you need to think beyond that, because the SSDs are, the rates we are creating, as we've seen now, having played with the Epic, the rates we are churning through data is just like another universe beyond what we're
used to. Batteries. We're churning through friggin' batteries.
Yeah. You're going to invest in two industries.
Batteries and SSDs.
But as I was putting, CF cards in and out of my Canon 5D, I was reminded that this is how we used to work with the Red One, the little CF card, and now we're just churning through half a terabyte every...
Admittedly, every morning. Were shooting basketball matches at 120 frames a second.
Sure.
5K.
Sure. The camera gives you the capability, so you're going to use it and you're going to just keep churning through it. I need to work out what the next version of the $800 stack of four half terabyte drives in a $300 sort of...
I know, I just feel like if you were serious about doing stuff and you had like an Epic, which let's face it is not a cheap camera, then having like a $10,000 or $12,000 or maybe whatever it is, $12,000.
Yeah, I don't know. Spending half the price of the camera again on something to store all the stuff it makes doesn't quite...
But like if you're spending $60,000 on a camera and $15,000 for a box, that on set means you can just stick cards in and not have to do any work, and it all just happens. And there's no, I don't have to stop what I'm thinking about because I've got to muck around with the laptop to sort this out. Because I find that the worst thing is to lose your train of thought because you're trying to dick around with stuff.
Right. You want it to be a process. Yeah. It's all about workflow.
And it does
process.
Need to be fast. It needs to be fast. It needs to be faster than the $800. Okay.
All right. Well, let's talk about the indie solution to that. I mean, when I sat and watched the Storm demo again at NAB, I was impressed with the fact that, this thing can do a lot. I mean, you could bring your files in, back them up, and then use Storm to create your rushes.
Okay, but hang on. Like, let's just be realistic about this. I love Storm, right? But what we're talking about is if somebody has a shot. If you stick an SSD in from an Epic,
not yet.
At FireWire on my laptop, it will take me 40 minutes to clear the card.
True.
Now,
even at ESATA, it comes 20 minutes or something. It's still
a lot. Yeah. Now, of course, Thunderbolt, as we've already discussed, is going to like massively change that. But still, right now, that's a heck of a bloody... And I might have four cards to clear.
Yeah, everything
I came at 2 o'clock the other morning from shooting on the Strip. I had 3 cards to clear. I'm watching repeats of, late shows on CBS or something until like 4 in the morning trying to clear the cards for the... It was a pain in the ass. And I had a new laptop, thus I couldn't put an eSATA thing in it. Where's the logic in that?
Yeah, right. I mean, the mobile, the normal sort of Red One sort of mobile data solution for that laptop hotel kind of thing would be like a mini RAID, like a G-Tech mini RAID thing, which would be half terabyte once you sort of stripe it in safe mode. And that's, that now, one of those drives now is filled in a couple of hours of mucking around in Epic Land.
Our workflow was to clone everything that had gone to the hard drives. So when we were wiping the SSDs, we had 2 copies of it.
Right.
So we had to shape it all from the SSDs to the drives and then clone the drives, which admittedly I did when I went to sleep.
Well, remember that we used to love FireWire 800. We used to think it was the coolest thing ever, and we loved it. But now it's becoming the real bottleneck. And ESAT has been a pain in the butt. So this Thunderbolt really does show the hold the promise to solve a lot of these problems, but there's still just a ton of data and time. And,
yeah, it's still going to be time. I think we, as far as we understand, there's SSDs out of, say, the Epic is that the, you start to have a system like Thunderbolt, which is way in excess of even what an Epic SSD can run at, which I think it tops out at about 140 megabytes a second to get the data off it. So even with Thunderbolt, you don't get a massive help in your how many of the late, late, late shows you get to watch.
So let's jump to the other end of the spectrum and discuss Sony's activities. So Sony seemed to have a kind of a modest booth. I know NHK was not there at the show. Oh, actually, before we get there, can I tell you something really, really interesting that I saw that's completely got nothing to do with anything? Because I went over to the North Hall, which is where I saw this huge space that was marked as NHK unfortunately can't be here because of the tragedy, and we look forward to them coming back next year. And it was just blocked off. And I totally respect the NAB for actually putting a sign up there rather than just saying, you know, empty. But there was this tiny booth over there by these guys, and we're going to do a story on this coming up on FX Guide once the technology is released. But but you know the time-lapse, well, not time-lapse, the bullet time, multiple camera array stuff. So this system, and I say I won't go on too long because we'll cover it on FX Guide, but basically this would fire those cameras, but not in a necessarily obvious linear coplanar circular array. And then it takes those images and triangulates all the geometry and then remaps the video or the stills onto the model and blends it. So what you do is, let's say if somebody jumps in the air and you've lit them with, you know, like dramatic lighting and stuff, and then all the cameras fire, what happens is you get a 3D model back with the person frozen in that pose, properly lit, and then that 3D model, which of course you can now rotate any which way, is what you would do a slow turn on for a bullet time, or they had it so that you would then load it in your iPhone for virtual reality or augmented reality. So you would actually sort of point your phone, for example, at the desktop, and on the desktop sitting on the coaster in your restaurant would be the waitress or the person that, you know, and it would look like it was really there because it was obviously hand wobbled and shaked and moved left and right. It would simply adjust the 3D model to the correct angle to make that the correct angle. So it looked like the person was standing on the coaster. Does that make sense? So it looked like you had a person, like a real, real person, photographically perfect, standing on your coffee table.
I think Jason didn't use to describe it. You wanted to see it in more of a Princess Leia mode.
Well, it is. It's Princess Leia without the blue horizontal line.
Without needing R2-D2.
And the repeating Help Me Obi-Wan.
So I could have Mike Seymour doing background fundamentals from PhD. You could be sitting on my coffee table doing it.
Well, the only thing is, Jeff, at this stage, that's stills.
Oh, it's stills now. But they're talking about it.
They're talking about video.
And wow.
So you can imagine,
wow,
if you went to a restaurant and literally, you know, they wanted to give you the specials and you pulled out your iPhone. I mean, it would obviously be a gimmick. You would put your iPhone aimed at the desk and suddenly there'd be a waitress standing on your desk or whatever describing the specials. But a restaurant's unlikely to do this, obviously, because it'd be a stupid thing. You'd have to do it every day. But what would be the case is you could go into a high-end, say, you know, clothing or retail environment, and that would happen. And of course, it'd be worth making an investment there for the summer collection because it's going to last for, like, you know, 3 months or something. So there's a lot of interesting possibilities, and I just thought it was like a really hoopy piece of new technology.
Interesting.
And I got to say, it rendered sensationally well because it's a completely, perfectly mapped 3D model, and there's lots of triangulation from the cameras. And they don't even need that many cameras. I mean, they don't need as many as you do for bullet time.
Where and it was fast?
Well, it's instantaneous when you're playing it back. Obviously, it takes it in an instant when you do it, but there's a processing step between taking the photo and putting it on an iPhone. Because
right.
That's got to get, that gets processed, and then, of course, it gets converted into whatever, and then loaded in the app that you're doing.
Sounds like that a more sophisticated version of the, on a lot of, they do a red carpet 360 camera thing nowadays on some of these, you know, award shows and stuff.
Yeah.
Where they, but that's basically the, like a Stitch type thing where they move, make a 360 camera so they can rotate around an outfit.
Well, yeah, which is fine, but that would be limited to where the camera positions were.
Right, this would make a 3D model out of it.
Yeah, and so therefore the move that you did around the person could be at any speed
right.
and in any direction, and they don't have to be, like, to left or right.
You can
go up or down or put a camera above their head and
yeah.
go over the top of them. So, I mean, okay, here's a better example. Imagine that you had a new car that was about to come out or some new camera or something. Imagine if you're in the store and there's, like, you know, coming out in 6 weeks is the new Canon 5D Mark III, and you pulled up your iPhone to the display and there was the, you know, Canon 5D Mark III sitting on the counter, and wherever you moved your phone it would see it from that angle, and you'd go towards the counter and it would get bigger, you move it away, get smaller, you go on top of it or underneath it, and yet, of course, in reality there's just the empty space there with some kind of Canon logo that gives it the tracking information it needs to lock down. Anyway, I just thought it was kind of fun, unusual piece of new tech. I was about to say about the when I worked over there, there was that, and in the end of the central hall was the Sony stand, which I thought was a little smaller than normal. But Jace, you spent some time at the Sony stand, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a bit of wander around. I mean, it's obviously one of the major things was the launch of their true 4K camera, which is obviously 8K / 4K. But we had a bit of a deeper sort of glimpse into that, Mike, didn't we?
We got to see the... Now, we're allowed to talk about it. We can't post any photos from the event, though we're getting some photos released to us. But I've got to tell you, the imagery looked good. Camera looked a bit big.
The imagery was just astounding. I was quite fully expecting that the imagery would just look as good as a red one. You know, expecting, you know, the resolution would look nice. But there, I've got to say, having seen it not just in... the monitor, and we should talk about one of the monitors we saw later, the monitors in that sort of back room area, but also on projected in 4K on the big Sony stand, having seen it now two or three ways against two or three screens, this definitely has a look beyond just, you know, pixel peeping. I can only describe the look as it has a very classy look. It's very smooth and very... It's just quite a gorgeous look, which I did not expect there to be any difference between this and any other sort of camera of a similar resolution. Very, very interesting look that you have to sort of see for yourself, and don't just go, okay, they make a 4K camera now, tick that off. It's something you have to actually...
But the camera was about the size... It wasn't quite the size of a Dalsa, but it was getting up there.
It's similar form factor to
F-35. That you photographed.
Yes.
Yeah, similar to F-35 and or, you know, Genesis type thing, essentially.
Did you get the logic? Did anyone get the logic of why it's called F-65? Because it's not actually 65.
No.
It's aspirationally 65?
Not quite sure why. It should be F-35 II or something, Mark II or something, but anyway, it's
F-45.
Yeah, this goes up to 11.
It'd be 33 and a third.
Yeah.
Everybody waved
the camera,
to the giant thermometer.
There was a couple of interesting things with the camera being bulky, as Ari has done, is they're doing like a split the camera system, whereby for 3D work you can essentially take the optics block out of the camera and mount it in a separate sort of pod thing, and then connect it back to the camera body again through, I think, what they call their T-link or their T-cable. Which unlike Ari, actually powers it, has all the data comes through, and I think that goes up to 30 feet or something or so, but essentially the ability to then use those camera heads in a 3D rig or aerial or you know, etc. rig.
As interesting as that camera is, and I'll come back to the monitor, I think that what you just touched on there is probably more interesting to a lot of people because it's more accessible, which is Ari's approach of splitting the camera in half. Do you want to explain that if somebody does?
Yeah, so apart from a couple of other things that Ari announced was the Alexa M, which is Alexa Modular. Obviously, they themselves are quite happy to admit that the Alexa itself, even though it's, you know, DPs around the board resoundingly love the thing, it is still quite a heavy... It is solidly built. It is a very solid camera, and it's still one of those cameras where, unlike, an Epic, where as soon as you cut, you're going to be looking around you for the guy to hand it off to. You want to say, okay, I'm cut, take it away, get it off me. it's bulky, and particularly obviously for 3D rigs, aerial work, etc., where you want to have something really light and minimal, and you want to be able to get cameras nice and close together. And so they've basically essentially cut an Alexa in half.
Where's the battery though? Because you said that unlike the Alexa, Sony ran the power.
The camera head is about 2.5 kilos, but you do then also have to power it through, VLOC and or.
So the VLOC sits up at the camera end.
Camera end and or can be wired to the camera block. It doesn't necessarily have to bolt onto it, but essentially, unlike the Sony system, the front part of the camera will need powering because it's only. The camera and body and head are connected via fiber optics. So unlike the Sony system where they're limited sort of 20 or 30 feet, this, I think they talked about the fiber optic link can be up to about 1 kilometer away, which is, I'm not quite sure why you'd need that, but there you go, you can.
But if I was wanting to use it in a 3D rig, could I not just run some power cable? I mean, surely a power cable.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Yeah, the power thing is not a plus, not much. It's just a weight thing. Yeah, I just wondered more from a weight point of view, or whether it needed to be the battery needed to be bolted right to the side of the thing.
I gotta say, when I was looking at it, my brain flicked to the old pictures of the. You know, remember the old 1970s backpack cameras that they used at sporting events? Yeah. I mean, it felt that size. Yeah. Now, obviously, the fiber optics cable, they said, was a prototype, so, it was garden hose size.
It did
was
feel big. Like, those big porta pack kind of connectors that you can twist lock things.
I was kind of like, you could have fit power in that cable, I would think.
Was it a working That's prototype, or was it like a cardboard?
It wasn't working, I believe. It's really just a test mule just to say, hey, look at us, we're doing something. What was interesting though, of course, being more of an epic head, is that the front half of the Alexa M is still bigger than an entire epic.
Well, I was thinking you guys were on the Technocrane booth for a while playing with the epic on the end of the techno. That was a good time. I was thinking about the fact that the area, you couldn't have put the Alexa up there because of this proprietary fiber optics cable. You would have had to run that separate cable.
Yeah. And you probably could have put a whole Alexa on there, but it was...
Yeah.
What the game we were playing with was actually sort of, I suppose, the epic version of a big, normal, massive Technocrane, which is a, roll it out of the back of a truck, three-man sort of operation. And here was... the sort of baby version of this. It still had quite a lot of length. I think it was 30 feet. But you had two people who had not used one before, one of which has a strong background in post-production. You could grab the camera and fly it with
Successful.
Yeah,
we got to thank the guys at Technocrane because they gave us the Technocrane booth for, I think, about an hour and a half.
Now, for those who are not familiar with Technocrane, the idea is that it is a telescopic camera that literally, with a flick of your thumb, you can extend the crane at 10 feet a second out, and obviously as it does that, the weight bucket goes, weight goes backwards out there to keep it in constant balance. It's not hydraulic or anything. It is still essentially a big lever. But it's fantastic.
It's massive.
Actually, one thing with that camera, that one, that's the first of their Technocranes, which is electronic. A lot of them are just like electromechanical, where it's just motors and wheels and pulleys and stuff. This is actually controlled quite electronically, and what they did say is they could spit out a lot of data for 3D and capture it.
On the one we were on?
Yep, on that one.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, which one of those?
Which was cool.
I mean, from a visual effects supervisor standpoint, being on set with one quite a bit, I will say that there's a tendency to think that it's a motion control thing and it's repeatable, and it's absolutely not.
Well, there was, funny you said that though, there was a motion control Technocrane right beside it. I know.
Because you hit it.
I smashed the first Technocrane with the Epic, $60,000 Epic, and into the other Technocrane, which was worth $500,000.
I have video of that.
The Technodolly, which is quite gorgeous, which is essentially fully remote control version of that. The track, height, boom, pan, tilt, every single thing is recordable.
It was self-aware, that one. That
yes, it
one
was
self-aware.
And I like the person sitting for you. Yeah, there was a person sitting with a safety stop button off to the side of the booth, waiting at all times for you guys to get close to it with the other one, and they would smash it to a stop.
Actually, at one point, I did actually hit it, and I was like, "Jace, I broke the Technicrane."
There was it looked broken, didn't it?
There was like, "Jeff, have you got your credit card?"
There was duct tape on the Technicrane when we left, so I took that as a.
But what awesome footage!
It was cool.
It was cool. Awesome.
It was cool. It was.
Yeah, and I should point out that I was controlling the crane, which was going in and out and left and right and up and down. But you were controlling the head.
I was doing pan and tilt.
You had the hot head.
You had to do height, speed, and in and out, and watch.
Also, you were directing. You were the one that was telling me to drop the Technicrane from about 30 or 40 feet straight down beside that guy that we didn't know.
But it's easy. Hey, look, you know, this was, you know, you had like, you know, an hour's train, not even training, an hour's experience with it, and you could pull it off without, you know, decapitating anybody.
Okay, I had played with a Technicrane with the Technicrane operator on set before. Yeah. But yes, it's very rare that on set you would go on set and they'd say, look, we've got this really big motion control Technicrane rig over here, which is, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we got this big Technicrane here with a $60,000 camera plus lens, 40, 50,
yes.
And then, hey, visual effects guy, do you want to play with it?
Yeah,
that doesn't happen as often.
No, it doesn't happen very often. No, although I'd never seen that handlebar interface for it before.
Like, oh my god, I swear to god, that was some of the most fun I had in Vegas.
Yeah,
I just had a ball.
I came around the corner and I was like, oh no, what are these guys into? This can't go well.
What could possibly go wrong?
And acres of high of supercomputer software rendering, etc., post path sort of gear. I just love it that your biggest kick is from.
Well, what about the other one, the scissor one?
Oh, right next door, yeah.
Does anyone remember the name of our mate on the guy?
I keep constantly trying to remember. Scissor Crane, or it was very, very clever.
It was just like that. I didn't get it either. You guys did that when I wasn't there, but I saw the guy.
So imagine a thing that if you know those old 50s cartoons that they'd have a punching hand on the end of a extendable thing, and you'd hold the other end, and it would sort of telescope out, punch somebody in the face, and telescope back. You described it as a scissor lift on its side, Jace.
Yeah, or one of those big expandable wine racks.
Or those, yeah, like those file folder holders that are like metal and they expand out.
Yeah.
Anyway, we were playing with that, and that was also fun. Now, that was considerably cheaper. That was like $1,700.
Did it fit in a suitcase? I didn't see it in a collapsed form, but it looked like it would fold right up.
Are we going to get some footage of that, like in an FX Sky something? Or we'll get some footage that we shot on that thing. It was hysterical.
Put it on YouTube.
That was a hoot.
Yeah. For what it could do, and obviously it wasn't just, you know, silly. It was very, very clever letting you do dolly in and out. Essentially, it's a slider and a crane all in one kind of thing, and they can all fold into a carry-on. The ability to very smoothly do vertical lift straight up, dolly boom straight in and out without seeing the track, unlike a slider. If you're moving in and out, there's only so far you can move back before you start to see the front of the thing you're moving on.
Yeah, right, and of course it doesn't have a hot head, so you don't have like an operator at the side.
I mean, you can put on a tripod and go from 2 inches off the deck to, you know, sort of 8 feet, 9 feet in the air, and or dolly in and move in, essentially move anywhere in 3D space around you.
Yeah.
Well, getting back to serious stuff for a second, what's our take on stereoscopic workflow or stereoscopic work? Because last year we'd had to say 3D was everywhere. Was the vibe here that 3D was growing? Had it petered out? I mean, Jeff, what's your take?
Well, you know, I didn't really spend a lot of time. I mean, obviously everybody had a 3D monitor in their booth and a pile of glasses, and there was 3D everywhere, but it wasn't... The first thing I did at the show was I went to the Red booth with you guys, and while you were talking to the guys and looking in the showroom thing, I went in one of the earliest showings of the Red movie, and the first thing they had was a theater with a 3D movie. And I had... And with the Oakley 3D glasses, of course, that you had to give back. But... And it was a beautiful 3D movie. I mean, the Blue Angel stuff, I really, really loved it. It was really gorgeous. But it played in a loop about three times before we got to go into the main room for the short they did about the Red Dragon. And I looked around, and after the first viewing, about a third of the people had their glasses off and could care less anymore. And after the second viewing, it was pretty much, you know, again, another percentage dropped off. And that was kind of how I felt about 3D in general. It's kind of like, yep, it's there. And, we know it's there and it's fine. And I don't know, what was your sense?
Yeah, everyone seems to have a bit of a handle on it now, don't they? It's like,
that's what I got from the Foundry. I spoke to Bill Collis at the Foundry and I said, what was your take on 3D? And he said, well, it's quieter about 3D, but not because it's gone away. It's because everyone's less panicked and got it more under control now.
Yeah.
And so it's like now less of a, I've got to solve 3D because I've got a job coming in next week, and where I'm nowhere, I'm in the weeds.
But yeah, but I think that that is definitely reflecting what's happening in post, and that everyone, and you know, camera rigs are out there, and everyone, you know, the tools are there to get it right. But I still think, speaking to a lot of people, and speaking to guys at your the FX got a PhD pool party, was there is a lot. There's a, in the field, there is still a vast amount of getting it wrong going on in the, you know, in production world. Post can handle it, and, but there's a lot of completely screwing it up at the capture end.
Yeah, I think I didn't feel like, whereas, you know, the SSDs and the other things we mentioned, the aggressive price wars, they felt, you know, pervasive. That wasn't the case. Now, that being said, one of the most impressive booths at the entire NAB was the 3ality one,
yes,
which was just unbelievably good. Yeah, I mean, so you've got to imagine, if you've never been to an NAB, a trade show is a thing with a lot of booths. You've seen it in movies and shows, and then people walk around and there are exhibits. And at, in the old days, what used to happen is if you had an exciting booth, then you had some, you know, sort of vaguely attractive renter model that would stand there and sitting on a green screen and try and not look bored while we all like aimed cameras at her and did tested out Kias and Ultimats, and that was considered an exciting booth. Well, Jace, you want to describe 3ality's booth?
Okay, well, so obviously in between the trade halls, which are enormous, there's an equally enormous sort of huge, I guess, like the sort of satellite farm area where there's a massive area for OB trucks, satellite dishes and stuff, and essentially what 3ality did was set up was a huge outdoor basketball court, and they had the wheelchair basketball match going on, because they really needed a lot of space. They had guys with steady cams, sideline cameras, cameras on jibs swinging over the so essentially it was a live mobile happening outdoor sports event that you could then go inside their booth inside and see it all playing live and all feeding and being switched.
To the right of it was a 3D OB van, so you could go if you were, you know, had, it wasn't, I don't think, open to the public, but they were definitely walking people into it. And so that was the broadcast hub, so a proper OB van set up doing that live switching of the event. And then inside they had a whole lot of monitors and stuff, so you could watch what was going on outside. Now, there is a moment where I did inside kind of go, but if I look out the window I see it in 3D too.
Hello, reality is just there.
Yeah. But yeah, actually, I've got to say, I loved Stu's comment at the post-pit event we did, where he said, why is it that people are so obsessed with reality? Reality isn't very good. We want the film industry. Yeah. Films aren't about reality. And he was joking that he wanted a Hollywood actress over a reality star. He wanted Kidman over Kardashian. But anyway, the reality stuff is that... that you're doing an ISO broadcast and you can do the 3D so effectively that you can do it live and without a lot of post-processing. But 3ality had a ton of just professional, well-done stuff. But I mean, they had the wheelchair teams. They also had normal athletes doing basketball. And they were not, you know, aggressively trying to play at the, you know, mega end, but they were definitely really serious athletes doing some fun, really good... demonstration game.
It's just a really good showcase of what they do. It was a brilliant setup.
Oh my
setup
god, what a professional setup.
Like a lot of the sort of booths, just they're restricted by space and they can only sort of give you a glimpse of what they really do, but this was a full demo of this is what we do. We come, we'll set up and we cover your event live in 3D and make it look great.
Which I guess brings us to the other thing that we noticed from the media point of view, which is everybody seemed to be obsessed with streaming from the show. Now, we did our bit to this ourselves. We did streaming on Tuesday afternoon live. But that was, I guess, from the other side of things. Like when we were talking to Ted on the first day, there were people holding iPads up aimed at me.
Yeah, they were iPad live streaming from the queue at the Red booth before it opened, wondering, you know, what is going to be the surprise.
And I guess we've got to ask you guys listening to this what you think about this. I mean, to my mind, I kind of like editing. Like, I like people to edit things and think about them and then comment on them and produce thoughtful kind of stuff. Now, we did a live event which went for 3.5 hours, but like, that's a really big commitment for somebody to just watch 3.5 hours of unedited material, let alone live for the whole bloody show.
You were on the Twit with Leo Laporte, and I thought they were doing a very professional, nice, clean job.
Really,
you know,
great job.
They were rolling in clips and videos, and I thought I saw Alex Lindsay tweeting that they were doing stuff, like they were going out and shooting stuff that they were bringing back for that or broadcasting from it.
Yeah, so you're right, absolutely. The Twit Network had a really good showcase. In fact, I would say that in terms of working with social media, it's the best that NAB's ever done.
Yeah,
it's what they should have done like 3 years ago.
Great to see the back end of the Twit thing, which I've constantly always just seen the front end. It was really good to see the guys at the back end sort of pumping that out.
But I mean, it felt like a TV production. I mean, it's so funny. It's kind of gone from like, you know, these guys with iPads all the way back to the 3-camera shoot with a little switcher and CG and...
Well, that's the thing. Like, the Twitch guys, or people, are incredibly now professional. I mean, apart from that, Leo was always professional. But, you know, he had producers, he had segment producers. They crossed to outside things that were coming back to the main area. The main area was professionally lit, professionally set up with cameras. They had a green room to the side. It was, you know, it just felt like, as you say, Jeff, it was like an outside broadcast in a TV sense. And just very well done by people that are used to broadcasting live, and so they don't get tongue-tied and they know what they're doing. And Jace, you were saying that because you know some of the other shows better than I do. I know the tech ones, but you were saying that they had quite a lot of the key, you know, other shows on the Twit Network other than just Leo's main shows.
Yeah, like, absolutely. The names of the guests elude me, but there was definitely... Yeah, it was a great panel that you were on. They had the guys who really delved down into their own individual podcasts and did some deep tech. So you're on the right bunch of people.
But it was fun doing that, and we want to thank those guys. We want to thank Alex for setting that up.
When you were on the Teradex booth also live, and you were also, Jason, you did something on Fresh TV. I know they were covering a lot of stuff live too.
And for Teradex themselves, which was, and we actually did a sort of teaser RC there as well, which was great, which was terrific to be.
I mean, I think
an
event coverage
on quite a small booth, but you know, we have 500 people.
Do you want to explain how we did the Teradex stuff? Because that's actually relevant both from a post point of view and from a production point of view, Jess.
Yeah, I mean, we had essentially the guys had, we just had the little camera top, their little cube transmitter, which is transmits from Wi-Fi back to a laptop, and that laptop was just plugged into the 3 megabit supplied, NAB supplied sort of booth. Net. So basically they had just a regular camcorder with a cube on the top, and way, you know, 30 feet away they had someone with a laptop plugged straight into the feed that NAB provided. So it was, and obviously also what part of the interactivity was, you know, how easy it was to get that whole chat room thing happening. It was quite impressive that, particularly when we were on with Fresh TV and those guys, we could... They had,
see, the thing I is, feedback. I can't watch back our post pit booth because it's live and unedited, and the first thing I want to do is cut out my lame jokes.
Sure. Or my.
And I just, I really like, I cringe. And normally I have the capacity to cut that out.
It's if
I
do very a joke, different
it's
headspace.
Totally lame. I just go, that was totally lame, let's do it again.
It's a very different format, isn't it, when you're sort of just thinking on your toes and form, you know, live and just sort of, you know, bringing people in and out.
We're not performers. Well, think about the FX Guide Live events we used to do at Vegas. We would spend, you know, 3 hours doing these things, and then we'd spend a year editing them down, because you just want to really hone it, and it's a different medium than watching it live.
Yeah.
But the immediacy, the live thing, I mean, I do really get Twittering and stuff. I love it. But that's, at least you get a chance to summarize down to 107, you actually have to be concise and you have to edit yourself. I don't know what stream of consciousness. I think, would Twitter even work if you could put in, like, you know, if it was like unlimited on how many characters you could put in?
Look, it's a very different, you know, mindset. And it is, you know, for me, having, this is only my second year going to the show, there's been many years where I have had to, you know, just sit back on the other side of the world and not attend, and but want to see, particularly when you've got stuff like Red, who like literally don't announce something till the doors open. To that live thing is quite important for those that can't attend. It's, you know, it's a big effort to head out there.
Well, I have to say, I think there's been a shift. I mean, I think the combination of the Apple event and Red's booth this year, I think both kind of signaled to me a little bit of a shift. The Red booth was kind of manageable this year. And the Apple thing, I was perfectly comfortable getting updates via people telling me from Twitter or seeing stuff on Twitter myself. And, you know, I'll sit down and watch the live thing at some point, the video at some point, at some quality level. Yeah. But I was totally fine, since it's not being released tomorrow, just kind of getting that update as we go along. I was fine with that. And I think that, you know, Red, I mean, they announced a lot of stuff, but it's not like previous years where it's like, oh, here's the epic.
Summarize for what they did announce, because we haven't actually talked about it.
I guess we haven't, no. And we should say that there's also there's a big FX Guide TV episode with a lot of the Red and Airy stuff in it. You talked to Ted right off the first of the bat, and when we got to the booth, everybody was wearing Red Dragon logoed shirts, and they had a tattoo parlor set up. So, like the basketball, standing out from the crowd, the tattoo parlor right there in the front with a celebrity tattoo artist.
Doing real tattoos, like permanently putting their logo and designs on people's bodies. So those girls, the mothers know that they're there? I mean, seriously, as a parent, I mean, really?
I never went over and saw up close if they were doing Red Dragons or if they were doing whatever they wanted.
They were putting a dragon logo, like on the back of the shirts, on this girl's back.
Wow.
Poor thing.
Wow.
No, I'm just joking.
But so, Mike, what's Red Dragon?
Dragon is basically the next chip. So it is to the Epic what the MX was to the Red One. It's the sensor upgrade that gives you more, but doesn't replace the camera body. It's a paid upgrade, of course, but it's their, you know, making obsolescence obsolete kind of mantra. So you can keep updating the modular nature of the Epic. Now, we don't know if it means swapping out the whole camera body, or it means just sending back your camera body and getting a new chip in. Nor will we, because it's not going to be released until 2012, which is to say end of next year.
And it's the Monstro chip, is that?
Well, it is. They're not calling it the Monstro chip. Well, no, I mean it is, but they're not calling it that, because if they did, they'd previously published the specs on the Monstro. Now, if you think that this chip specs were announced a couple of years ago, and it's not going to go into a camera until next year.
Ah, yes, right.
But if they called it Monstro, then everyone would start pulling out the pieces of paper and saying, you said the Monstro was going to be X, Y, and Z, and they don't actually want to commit to what they are. Now, we say they don't want to commit, but Jace, you want to take a bet on how long till they start publishing Monstros, or rather Dragon specs on Regis?
Monstro was originally anything above Super 35, because I think even like the 645 and the huge 617 were all the massive cameras like were Dragon. Called, you know, Monstro sort of chips, from my memory.
And Ted said they have, on the post pit, he mentioned that they actually have that silicon, the big one, the 617.
617, yeah, well, they said they had it working.
Right. But I mean, that it's not a dead project, is my point. That they are still working on it.
It's the same sort of chip. Actively. It's just a cut a bigger chunk out of the wafer.
But they wouldn't commit to what size this Red Dragon chip was going to be, right? No. There was rumors it was a full frame.
It is, I think. I say that not from an NDA.
I hope and wish for full frame. And because it does kind of make sense, because obviously they've got a Canon, active Canon, and Nikon mounts coming, which obviously are all that glass is fully capable of covering.
We talked about that. We haven't talked about that on this podcast.
No, because it is still technology that, as you've seen, you have seen it, Mike, in the hand. And
yeah, when we were at Red and we picked up the Epic, we actually saw the Canon
active Canon mount
on the Epic, which was truly, I mean, that was a day of just like, you'd held the prototypes, you've seen the specs, and then to be handed an Epic with a Canon lens on it and touch the screen and it autofocuses, and just the Epic with the Volt battery on it with a small form factor and the Canon lens, it was pretty mind-blowing.
So I didn't dream that. That was real.
It was real, and it was a white Epic too, which was also quite
not bizarre. Easy. Not easy technology to do.
Yes.
What Jared's. They're trying to achieve is not easy. I mean, if essentially, for those that don't know, this is essentially like what you have with your iPhone now, that you can touch any part of the screen and that becomes the focus point. And when if you couple that with gorgeous Canon professional lenses in something the size of almost a stills camera, this also obviously goes back to one of the original sort of concepts of what they call the DSMC, Digital Stills and Motion Picture Camera, that you can use this camera for both and press a button to make a still as while you're rolling film.
And Mike, you've said multiple times this trip that I haven't seen you with a 5D in your hand the whole trip.
I mean, yeah.
You shot a time-lapse with it. I think that's about all you did with it.
I did shoot a time-lapse with it, and I had a great little gadget, which is a sort of a suction cap skirt thing that sticks onto the camera and onto the glass that means you can do time-lapse without having to worry about reflections on the glass. But that was about the only time I used the 5D because, you know, I'm shooting sort of high-resolution stills at 120 frames a second. Why do I need to have a... I mean, I do obviously get it, but I didn't want to carry both, and the Epic trumped the Canon, and you'd kind of expect it to. And obviously, we've got a bit of a crossover here into kind of Red Center territory for FX listeners because we've got Jason the car and stuff, so we're not going to try and go too much into that territory. But, yeah, no, it is true. We definitely found that to be the case. And I've got to say, I don't think it was just me, and I don't think it's just because you're with us, Jace, but I think a lot of the action, not all of it, but just a significant amount of the action that was hot was happening in the camera arena at this NAB rather than in the post. There wasn't, like, huge new... I mean, you know...
It didn't seem to be... Yeah, it did there. Like, I mean, apart from the... A lot of the stuff outside of that, as we've touched on, was it seemed to be around the Blackmagic universe.
I think Blackmagic were very strong. I think Adobe was strong this year.
AJA, still good
did
stuff.
You spend any time on the Autodesk booth?
You know, I went by and said hi to people, but you know, the 2012 releases we covered very extensively about a month before the show, and we posted the 2.5 hours of videos with Philippe going through the features. And I mean, the excitement on that from Flame and Autodesk user people is incredible, and I just can't wait to get back and hopefully jump on to 2012 immediately because of the EXR support and just a lot of the new improvements they've done. The planar, not planar tracker, what do they call it? Point cloud tracker, which pretty much gives you planar tracker on steroids. There's so many good things in this new release that I'm excited, and it's an interesting thing that they did it so far in advance of the show this time, but in some ways, they usually, you know, gives you time to build some excitement and interest in it. I know it took me a while to go through all those videos and kind of digest all the new features, and I'll be going back another round of those, I'm sure.
You know what was one of the things in post that I just loved that was released at the show? It was released by our good friends Jim Ashwitz, who visited us on Tuesday. It's LUT Buddy. Now, Jeff...
Well, I was working up at the orphanage, a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
And Stu, we needed to build some LUTs for the Flame. They did not have a Flame at the orphanage, and Stu, and I really feel bad about this, but I can't remember the guy, the color science guy's name, really great guy. They walked into my room and showed me this little app it was a plug-in at that point to After Effects, I think, and they could run stuff through this app and generate LUTs, and it was genius. And so now it's on the Red Giant site in the free software section, along with a Colorista version, Colorista Free.
Because the orphanage closed, and so Stu went to Red Giant and said, I think you should buy this technology. So Red Giant bought it, and then, I don't know how he did it, he then convinced Red Giant to give it away.
Yeah, he said it was one of those things you either had to make it so expensive, you know, that a few people would buy it, or just, you know, put it out there. And it seems like a really, I'm really excited to play with it too. I was impressed with it back then.
It's so great.
I mean, it's that Stu generosity and magic. I mean, he's given so much to the community that this is just one more thing. It's like, wow, nice.
I was so impressed with LUT Buddy that I can't even remember the other free thing that
it was Colorista things. Free,
okay,
which is basically a very stripped down version. Not stripped
my
down.
Priorities.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of a limited version of Colorista, which we all love. All the FX Guide TV goes through Colorista before it goes out.
Now, does that mean next year DaVinci going to pay us to use DaVinci?
I think so. I think we're getting to that point, yeah. Oh, and also the Colorista Free supports the CDL, which is not in Colorista right now, so it's a little bit ahead of the game. So I could see Colorista Free being a pretty nice tool for, you know, a director pulling up some shots and kind of tweaking and setting a look and then exporting a CDL, if that's being used very widely, I'm not sure.
On that thought, two quick things with the jumping back to Resolve, the full version of Resolve. is that they've now got implementation. You can now use, you're not restricted to using the Wave panel or their $25,000, obviously incredibly impressive panel, but they've also got, you can now use the Euphonics MC.
So
MC Color, I think it is. Yes, which is now owned by
Avid.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And the JL Cooper, which are both, you know, like $1,000, $2,000 kind of dollar panels.
I went over to JL Cooper. They were in the North Hall as well. They were really in the wrong place. I've never seen a booth more in the wrong place than that one.
But both really much more impressive panels than the Wave, which to me is just, you know.
Wait a minute, Sony. I only saw the Sony booth back in the camera area. Did they not have their normal big booth upstairs? Kind of.
Oh, that's the point, actually.
Tape machine. I didn't go upstairs at all.
I
feel bad.
No, I didn't. Yeah.
Huh. Well, there was so much to see. We barely got through what I wanted to see. I mean, the Central Hall was a big draw.
So let's have another chat about something that, and this is a real crossover for RC, but I guess we're not going to do a different RC, so this is worth doing. So, Jace, we went and had a look at a shootout that was at Sakudo's booth, and want to thank them for inviting us into that. It
that
was really kind of really nice guys at Sakudo, I've got to say. I've got a lot of time for those guys.
Absolutely, they do put a lot back into the community, and they are very consciously making it known that this shootout is a completely independent thing, and they don't influence it in any way, and they're quite out in the open about the fact that they want to make that known.
So do you want to set it up for us, like what we actually saw?
So this is, I guess, their next generation of... their take two of the original shootout they did last year. And adding some of the new generation of cameras like Alexa and Sony F3 and a few other things into the mix. That obviously every time they do this every year, there's a whole new batch of cameras to test. But essentially, basically comparing them... so that you can kind of work out what horse you want to put on what course, comparing film and a couple of film stocks, and Sony F3, Sony F35, Alexa, DSLRs, a range of DSLRs, and comparing them with dynamic range, sharpness, rolling shutter, and all the sort of issues, showing the inadequacies and highlights and where each sort of section of that market has its real strengths and weaknesses. And it was a real... I saw the original sort of shootout, and I thought that was quite impressive. This was a real eye-opener in terms of what now shines and what previously shone and was, considered gold standards is now sort of has its crown kind of slipping, really.
What did you think of the cameras?
The two main things for me that were sort of, three things I think were, A, how in many areas, how, I'm going to say badly, how poorly film holds up against some of them now.
Was it you that said at the end, we used to say film was the gold standard?
Yeah. I mean, you've long held that as digital cameras and digital cinematography cameras were developing, that you know, you were all trying to reach the sort of, the holy grail of trying to reach what film could do. And there obviously was one area where film still held its ground, which was into the highlights, being able to see in that hot stuff. But outside, everywhere else, in every other department, there was one of the cameras that nailed film in every. In terms of into shadows and noise and obviously what was clear every time we cut to film, we could immediately see gate weave and dust and scratches and this is stuff that's been nursed through the process, and this was still, you could definitely see all the physical side of gate weave and stuff, but that was one of the main things was apart from the highlight stuff, that film was not looking great at all. And also the next step probably for me was the Sony F35, which has previously been quite a real sort of go-to camera for a lot of people. And even just the very latest Transformers Dark of the Moon was shot on F35. That was their camera of choice. That's a 1080p camera, but that's starting to show its age a bit. But the, I suppose the standout probably for me was the Sony F3, which I had a chance to shoot some early with an early pre-production camera, and this was also shot on the pre-production camera. But how well that holds up against film and, you know, the four times more expensive Alexa, it just was quite a, you know, for a $15,000 or so camera.
Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind, you're absolutely right, that it, I was significantly surprised at how well the F3 looked and how well it looked like the F35.
Yeah, and like, apart from the highlight stuff, nearly every test, it was almost, it was up there with the Alexa, like, you know, a $90,000 camera.
Yeah, and it was really good.
Quite
and
impressive.
Yeah, they were pretty good about it. They were saying, you know, like, look, it's just, there's a good camera for each job. And
exactly right. That's,
you know,
it's not designed to, you know, it's not a competition to say which one's the winner.
Epic in there, though.
It's, yeah, Epic would have been really interesting to
Alexa
see.
Alexa on
there. Yeah. Again, you know, maybe, you know, next year, obviously.
Oh, the Alexa was just ProRes.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, it wasn't like, I'm not criticising them for doing anything wrong or being biased or anything else. I'm just saying, when they did the test, they couldn't get an Epic, and it would have been nice if they could.
Yeah. Next time. That shows how quickly this stuff changes, you know, literally within, you know, 2 months of, a month, 2 or 3 months of them shooting it, it's already not out of date, but, you know, it needs updating. Yeah. Epic would have been interesting to see in there, particularly obviously in the highlights with its HDRX ability to see into the hottest part of the sun.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression was that there wasn't, like, there wasn't the goal and there wasn't the case, that there was like, okay, here's the clear winner, this is the camera you should use for everything.
No, it was very much like, this will inform you. So, for example, you are informed how terrific the rolling shutter isn't a problem on the Vice Cam and the Phantom. You say, okay, look, that looks really good. That's
and how
as good
film.
As film, if not better.
Yeah, and how amazing no rolling shutter really in film.
And yet, if rolling shutter is not relevant to you because it's an interview, where rolling shutter is completely irrelevant, well, then who cares, right? I mean, you could roll, not roll, I don't care. Shallow depth of field might be the thing that I care about, in which case I want a big sensor and, you know. And quite frankly, the other thing is just how much the bloody things cost.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're comparing...
Exactly. That's another one of the comparisons, you know.
I mean, imagine doing a car comparison where one of the cars was not, like, twice as expensive or whatever, but like 10 times expensive, you know. So
one of the comparisons that's missing is probably, show me the pile of cash that you need for each one of these cameras. A very small little sort of pile for some of the low-end DSLRs.
Text you need sitting there to process it, or show me the data arrays that are going to need to be set up to handle it.
Well, it's the right tool for the right job. I mean, I think we've talked about that a lot this trip. I mean, we've shot almost all of our interviews with DSLRs because, you know, we just can't deal with the workflow on the Epic at this point.
And why would you be able to take stills as well without having to lug three or four cameras through the massive amounts of kilometers that you clock up on these trade shows.
Right. I mean, this is the first year I think we haven't brought
it out. We actually did use the Epic on the Red interview.
On the Red interview, that's true. We did.
And we used it for B-roll. In the sense of, you know, we did pretty shots around Vegas and stuff. But that's fine. Like, I mean, that's totally cool.
Yeah.
I love the 5D for doing the kind of work that we were doing on it. I didn't pull out the 5D for interviews simply because we had, I don't know how many bloody 5Ds there. I mean, we must have had five Canons in our kit this year.
Yeah, at least.
So I just didn't need to pull mine out.
I mean, we had a table full of batteries and lenses and wireless mics. And
actually, we had a pretty impressive array of lenses between the PL glass and all of the Canon L glass. It's a pretty good glass.
Yeah.
Hey, what did you think about the fact, Jeff, that Canon's going into PL glass?
I didn't get a chance to see the lenses. I was kind of intrigued by that. It seemed like I don't know. I'm interested in seeing Canon glass on Epics at this point, and the regular Canon glass, not PL mount Canon glass. I mean, because it's just not my world. It's not, you know, not in my outside professional life. You know, obviously on set, I'd like to see those lenses if I needed those lenses. But you know, outside that world, I'm more interested in the smaller form factor and all that.
We kind of forced you into being a Canon guy because of its operability with changing files and stuff. But did you see Nikon at NAB?
Didn't see them. Didn't look. I mean, look, I love Nikon, and I really, you know, at the it was a hard decision for me to sell my Nikon gear. But having said that, the joy of just being able to be totally comfortable with a camera in your hand and switch between stills and video, and I just, you know, and the, being able to do these interviews and shoot B-roll, and it's just, I love it. I love it. You know, I'm sure that it's going to switch. I'm sure that I'll switch at some point to something else, but I don't know what that'll be. But well, I'm really loving it right now.
In the shootouts that we had, and that was starting to hold up quite well now, actually.
The 7,000 or something?
Yeah, the 7,000.
Yeah, I hear good buzz.
Yeah, held up, you know, well on counts.
I just would really love for Canon to give us, A, an output that we could record to something reasonable, like the Key Pro from Asia, or the Atmos or something like that, Ninja. And I'd also love them to give us a or record at least to a better format than H.264.
Yeah, the Canon PL glass, if nothing else, does show that they, and we have, when we do know through our sources, they do have a timeline to work to. We know that they have plans. We just don't know what they are. Unlike on the other companies who are,
well, the PL glass you mentioned, they said that they fit a very specific underserved range, and they were very low. What was there? The T-stop was very low, right?
Yeah, it was like a wide end zoom. I don't remember the T-stop, but it was like an 18 to 60 or a 17 to 60 or something like that, which is not an awful lot of range there. But I mean, I would have preferred that they did something that. There is other options in those sizes, so I would have preferred they actually did something that no one else was doing.
Yeah.
Well, as we pass through our agricultural inspection zone of the Californian state, Jace, your pick of the show?
Wow. Well, a pick of the show almost isn't really at the show. My pick of the show that wasn't at the show is probably, from what I start to see, is Final Cut Pro. And even though I'm a director, I use that piece of software almost daily in my life. And to see finally something that hasn't changed much since the, you know, first 1.25, 8 years ago or so, that was good to see. Probably the next one, essentially, as a hopeful one day down the track Epic owner and a lover of full frame beyond super 35 frame, the Red Dragon announcement is a killer, and it means that if I did end up with an Epic, that I wouldn't then have to be forced to some sort of log into eBay to move on to the next version. That's actually going to be an upgrade versus sell and buy. So very, very happy about that one,
Mr. Hughes, my friend.
I mean, overall, the last month leading up to NAB and NAB itself, I think that I'm really intrigued by the small form factor that the Epic brings. In terms of an overall show pick, you know, it's funny how Apple can be sneaky. That Thunderbolt announcement not too long before this, and then the Final Cut stuff, I think we're entering a whole new world of speed and flexibility, and that excites me. I think that some bottlenecks have just been cut free. And frankly, I mean, I hate popping little stupid cards into laptops that don't even have those slots anymore. You know, and they spring out when you go to bump the side of the laptop. And I mean, this just makes for, it can really change things. You know, LED lighting was kind of the big thing at IBC, and certainly they were everywhere, including Fresnel's, now by people like Lowell. Yeah, I mean, amazing. I mean, it is really amazing. I mean, I think that's really interesting. And like we talked about the SSDs, and I don't know. I think Apple's the stealth kind of winner on this show in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the winner for me, a single impressive thing. The OELD 4K, under wraps. It wasn't on the show.
I'm glad we finally worked our way back to that mic, because that was probably, again...
It was. I've got to tell you, so let me just describe this for you. We're in this 8K presentation, and there's a really good presentation that happens, and it's fine, and the cameras, they're all working. And then they say that they'll get... I knew the screen was going to be there, because I was like, my radar was up for it. But it was under literally a black cloth, and I was thinking, they're not going to show it to us? And they said, no, we will show it. It's just that after the presentation's over, they'll show it to you. And so they should finish, and I'm like hanging around, and they all want us to look at the... And I thought, at this stage, I thought that there was something like they were going to be, ta-da! And I simply think that the second you took the cover off this bloody monitor, their 8K camera just wasn't interesting in the room anymore. Because, you know, if I was in the room and Steve Jobs walked in, I'm not worth talking to, you know? And so, literally, Steve Jobs and the Messiah walked into the room from a technical point of view having a chat, and it was 4K in the most gorgeous. I've seen 4K projected at the Red Booth, I've seen 4K projected in IMAX. This is the best 4K display device I have ever seen.
I completely and utterly agree. And I was up the other end of the room. They just at the same time unveiled this 8K camera that I could play with. And Mike's like, Jace, come down this end of the booth.
Put the black cover back on before she leaves.
I said, yeah, look, I'm just playing with this just released 8K camera up here. And she said, no, Jason, come down this end now. And boy, that was, it was, you know, it seems kind of
really
weird
funny.
To
is
be.
In those presentations, they always have those Japanese engineers at the side that don't say anything. And one of the guys said to me, and this is the guy that was, you know, the head of the design team, and I went over and started congratulating him and shaking his hand. I don't think he would have done that. But it was, the blacks were just volcanically black.
That is going to be the next thing for monitors, not just for the 4K, but OLED is when you see what it's capable of and get the rundown on what OLED does versus what even, you know, really, really good LCD and really, really good plasma can do.
And what we haven't told you is this is a 40-inch OLED. I mean, it was just like...
It was near religious experience to look... It's looking into the eye...
It was glossy.
It was beyond...
And the lights
amazing.
Were up in the room. It wasn't like they, you know, it was a lights-out presentation.
And like you said, we've seen 4K before. We've seen 4K projected. We've seen OLED monitors. We've seen all these technologies before. But literally, that was...
I just was like, I had an Epic in my bag. Yeah. I was like, oh my god, can I play my footage on this? Which, you know, was pretty uncool.
It's pretty uncool in the Sony booth. Not just the Sony thing, but the Sony inner sanctum.
Inner sanctum, 8K area. But I'm, you know, like all I wanted to do was see our footage on this screen. Like I was running it through my head. Is there any conceivable way, without being lynched, that I can get our footage on this? No,
because they were. Showing some pretty utterly amazing footage on it. Would have been great to see something that we know and we had seen before.
And you were the you said, oh my god, I really don't want to be a focus puller in this industry anymore.
No, it was like you now need to get serious glass and serious crew
and
serious onset monitoring.
I would add to that, I would not want to be a roto artist in this industry once people have that either.
Yeah.
Because you know, like it was breathtakingly nasty on visual effects.
Well, and plus the stuff about people now wanting to shoot 48 60 frames per second, I mean, the roto artist is doomed.
But you know, like occasionally you see stuff and you go, really, like it just looks like, I mean, like people go, is that HD? Well, no, it's just you know, up-resed SD. And you go, oh, okay.
Well, here's a thought then.
Honestly, Jeff, this did not look like anything that is
If this comes to your town, if the Sony have, you get a little email that comes through from some mailing list that says come to this private demonstration.
4K,
go and do it.
But what I was going to say is Ted and Red in general has been saying 1080 is not enough. Period. And the Red Ray they mentioned at the show, Ted this again said that the small Red Ray unit is going to be available because they still believe that 1080 is not enough, even in the home.
And that's just been rhetoric up until now. Until that moment, until I saw that monitor, that now I totally get what they're talking
about. It was like
about.
Sony validated Red.
Yeah, Sony validated
Red. But I was thinking about it, I must admit, from a production point of view, because there are huge issues about whether that'll ever get into the home. But just... Sure. If I went to DD, if I went to ILM, like this is the screen that I would like have in the meeting room where I showed our reel in 4K off a server downstairs. And you know, that's where it'll hit first, obviously. I mean, I have no idea how much this thing was going to cost. But, you know, it was 40 inches for crying out loud. Yeah. And we know nothing is more certain than this is going to leak down and seep to the consumer level at some point. Maybe it's 10 years away, but... Yeah. I can imagine this being in a post house in two years, do you reckon? Maybe? And honestly, it would be like, you would look at this and you would you're going to both love it and hate it.
Because literally all up until that point, that whole sort of megapixel or the, you know, the K race, it's been as bad as uninteresting as the megapixel race in DSLRs that, you know, we can do 20 megapixel, we can do 50, whatever, doesn't matter. No one really wanted more than, you know, say 9 or 10. And that's been the same.
But,
you know,
in a way that 3D has not excited me.
Interesting.
And by the way, we're about to hit Barstow and I think we're going to stop for lunch. So we're probably going to have to wrap up this podcast. So I hope you've enjoyed the trip across the desert with us. If you want to know what it's like to hang with our crew, this is pretty much what it's like. We've pretty much decided to tape our conversation, which we always have as we come across the desert, because quite frankly, I find it to be one of the most enjoyable things we do in travelling. And Jeff and I have been doing it for years now. I know, Jace, you've joined us for the last couple of years, but
they
literally...
It's not all like this.
Sometimes we talk about optical flow and good compression.
And we've had those dinners, you know, this trip. We've had some amazing sit-around conversations that, you know, at some point you have to stop recording and filming everything, but it is the best part of the trip, is having the time to hang out with mates. And, you know, I wish that John could have been in the car with us this trip add to this. But
to paraphrase the iTunes guys who do the essential stuff, this is the stuff we obsess about, this is the stuff we talk about, this is the stuff we live and breathe, and we just wanted to include you in the conversation, and we hope we have. Obviously audio quality is going to be somewhat subject to wind noise and stuff, but hopefully you've enjoyed the trip with us. I know many of you actually listen to this in your car, so if you like it and you want us to do it again next year, just send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Jace, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, look, thanks guys, it's been a blast. I'm loving it, and it's great to, as I said before, see it in person. And
and Jeff, thank you so much for not totaling the car and killing us all.
No problem.
Driving in a relatively straight line. Driving better than Mike's crane operating.
Yes. Yeah, I wanted to post that video.
You did pay him for that, right? Anyway, we'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks so much. Bye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.